work session. Council.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is regarding work session on Senate Bill 126. You hopefully recall this from February 7th. We had testimony. This is the bill that allows the court, a juvenile court, to order a parent or guardian of a youth who is on probation to pay a supervision fee. And Steve Dye, who is here, and Carl Myers, who are here, is also here, gave testimony on that date. I asked for legislative counsel to draft an amendment, which is proposed amendment -1, which would make two amendments. On page 1, line 18, after the word pay, it would insert, quote, all or a portion of, so that the court could order a parent to pay either the entire supervision fee or a portion of it. The other amendment would be on page 2, line 2. The language currently says that the court shall consider the ability to pay of the parent or guardian, and the amendment would change that to determine, so that the court would have to make a determination of the ability to pay. I think Mr. Myers is here and can be questioned about his support of those amendments if necessary. And that's really it. If any members want me to do anything else, I will.
Senator Duncan, are you going to be around?
it's
all right. Senator Harper, would you move the -1 amendments for me?
No. Senator Duncan's going to do this. I'll move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 126.
All right. Senator Harper moves the -1 amendment on Senate Bill 126. Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Harper.
I'll move Senate Bill 126 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Harper moves Senate Bill 126 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Anybody want to volunteer to carry this thing?
I'd be delighted.
Senator Harper will carry the bill. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Work session.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the next work session is on Senate Bill 352. Connie Gallagher is here. She gave us testimony on this bill on February 22nd. You may recall that this is the bill that changes the time limitation for a victim who sustained catastrophic injuries, extends the time period during which the Department of Justice can pay out benefits to a victim who sustained those injuries. There were no amendments. We just did not have time to do a work session on the 22nd.
Okay. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move Senate Bill 352 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 352 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered, and Senator Burdick will carry the bill. Thank you. And Esker, do you want to go on Senate Bill 444?
Sure. Okay.
Okay, we'll do a public hearing on Senate Bill 444.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 14, and thank you very much for our public hearing today on Senate Bill 444. I'm going to leave most of the bill description and reasons for it to Ms. Cindy Baker from Clackamas, who was a citizen advocate who brought this issue to my attention last year. We have a number of folks in the audience to testify on this bill. I will say, Mr. Chair, we worked diligently on this in the prior to session with work groups from Department of Parole and Corrections, and also since session began, to put together the elements of the bill to reach consensus on that. And Appreciate the opportunity to present that today. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to introduce Cindy Baker, who will actually introduce the bill and the reasons we're here today.
All right. Thank you, Senator.
Hello. Good day. I appreciate the forum to even being able to present this. I didn't even know this was available to me as a citizen. So my goal today is to hope that I can influence you and gain your approval and signature for this particular bill. And the reason is I'm looking for, as a citizen of the state of Oregon, a reliable and formalized review process that we can adopt in the placement of paroled sex offenders back into our communities. With this, I was hoping that you'll be able to understand why this is the best choice in this process. That the consistent review is important across the different counties and administrators that are involved. Excuse me. We're also looking for how we can provide consensus of the participants in the communities prior to a release of a parolee. The benefits that I see would deliver with this approval would include that the review process by the administrators of the sex offender by using consistent assessment guidelines and matrices during review and placement. This method would allow for the standardized review and documentation. I think the focus is for there to be a due diligence and to note the exceptions to that rule versus the focus on the prohibition associated with that. Also along with that is the early notification for the Department of Corrections as well as the citizens in our different communities. The way that it works now is with the current model is the notification occurs after a decision is made. In our original meeting that we had with all the representatives from different counties, Department of Paroles, et cetera, it was noted that there is some timing issues there that could be addressed. So I do feel like we have consensus to address that. The reason I'm bringing this forward from the problem standpoint is in our neighborhood back in the fall, September, just before school started by about 10 days, our community was notified by the parole officers that there was a sex offender that was being released into our community. Well, that wasn't such the big issue as it was that this person was being placed directly across diagonally from a school, a junior elementary school. This particular sex offender had a history of preferring 5 to 12-year-old girls. So this, I couldn't understand why this would occur. So there was a community meeting that was established. We were notified by the school district. Unfortunately for some of the people that conduct that meeting, I thought it was a fairly hostile meeting, but went away wanting to do something in a more proactive and positive standpoint. So from that, I ended up here. Met with a group of people, put together what we thought was a reasonable accommodation both for citizens as well as those that are in the administrative role of overseeing sex offenders, and to look at how we could best work together on a reasonable effort for both parts. I think it's important to note that the things that we've proposed don't really change what's currently being done to any drastic step other than formalizing the process. Formalizing the documentation process, creating a matrices that could be used consistently across all the organizations, and then tweaking that one piece that allows for the earlier notification of the community so that they can provide some influence and input in advance versus after the fact. So with that, I ask for your support, I ask for your approval, and I ask for your influence of those that work with you. Any questions?
I don't have any questions. It seems to make sense to me. Any questions?
I also would like to add, just so this it wasn't just one person that's speaking up, because I know they go to these meetings and they get assaulted and all this badness goes on, but I took Sunday afternoon and went around just our neighborhood, and there's 70 lots in our neighborhood. I think four or five of them are vacant lots. They're already owned, but they're not built on. And I did gather additional signatures just from my one neighborhood, also demonstrating in support of this particular bill. So I don't know if you want to add this to the information you have, if it's important or not. I don't know.
We'll take it for our committee records. So. Is this the first time you've testified in front
it is.
Of the Judiciary Committee or the Legislative Committee? You did a fine job.
Oh, well, thank you.
I'm surprised you didn't realize this avenue was available to you, though.
Well, I was pleasantly surprised when I made a couple of phone calls to Senator Metzger's office and the Attorney General's office, and I got quick response and a quick meeting set up, and it seemed like all the decision makers were in the room, and we were able to come to a mutual agreement of what the best approach should be. So
like
seemed to work well.
It always works that way.
Oh yeah, I bet. Yeah, just like it does in my work.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator.
Okay.
Darcy Baker.
Good afternoon. No relation to Cindy Baker, just coincidence. And before the paperwork is passed out to you, I will confess to a typo. In some places, you'll see it written as Senate Bill 744. I'm also on a work group for Senate Bill 740. And so in my mind, these numbers are crossing. But trust me, I know what bill we're talking about here today, and that's 444. I'll give you just a few minutes to scan the document there.
And just blather on.
Okay. I would just like to support what Cindy has said to you today. You know, it's a rare occurrence in my business when I go out and I make the call for citizens to get involved and help to make community safer that somebody actually steps up to the plate and takes that role on. And so I'm very appreciative of the work that Cindy did and also Senator Metzger in calling all the players to the table to draft something that works for all the citizens, not only in Clackamas County but throughout the state of Oregon. This particular bill does not diminish the work that parole and probation officers are doing right now. It simply enhances that. We are already going through a decision-making process. Every time a sex offender comes onto our caseload, we're looking at the particular residence. We're looking at the individual characteristics of that case and of that neighborhood to come up with the best plan. Of course, where the concern comes is when we do a community notification in a placement that is close to locations where children are the primary occupants. And that's not our first choice, but sometimes that is the best choice that we are left with. And it's important that parole and probation officers are allowed that opportunity to develop the best placement site for the sex offender, to be able to do notification, to have a conversation with the community and explain to them why this is the best choice, why it makes sense. This bill also addresses the transitional housing, and there is an exclusion for notification while offenders are in transitional housing. Approximately 50% of our releases from the institution in Clackamas County are subject to transitional housing. And if we had to do notification for something that was just a temporary residence, we would just be in the notification business, and that would solely be our focus when we know that many things go into quality case management, not only doing home visits, but making sure people are in treatment, getting polygraph examinations, working on those other issues. So, you know, this bill allows for that transitional housing exception.
Just a point of clarification, if
yes.
I understand correctly, counsel whispered in my ear, the transitional housing issue is contained in the Dash 2 amendments. And if I understand also, Dash 2 supersede the Dash 1 amendments. And these are yours. I mean, that's
yes,
the work groups.
Members.
Work groups. Okay.
Yes.
Just so the committee knows.
So the Dash 1s are in a.
Just draw a line through them now. Dash 2 supersedes.
Okay.
Any additional comments? Questions?
Any questions for me?
I don't think so.
Thank you.
All right, Diane Ray.
And then hand me that paper back.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Diane Ray. I'm the chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 444. My testimony today is on behalf of the Board of Parole and also on behalf of the Department of Corrections. Assistant Director Scott Taylor, who also worked on this bill, is unavailable today, but he asked me to express his agency's support of this bill as well. I, like Ms. Darcy Baker, would like to thank Senator Metzger, his staff, and Cindy Baker for bringing this issue to our attention in the manner in which they did, allowing us to meet before session and talk about the practical reality of implementing a bill like this. I think served all parties well, and I think ultimately will serve this bill very well in the long run. The Board of Parole is responsible for setting all of the conditions of supervision for parole, and we also have the authority to approve or disapprove of residences for offenders released from prison. And as you can imagine, housing for sex offenders is a real challenge in this state. There really are not any long-term halfway houses located in remote areas away from where adults or children live and work and come and go every day. Ideally, I think for certain sex offenders, we'd like to be able to place them in remote places where people feel safer and not having to interact on a daily or on a casual basis, but we just don't have that luxury. Instead, we have to rely on the support of family and friends of the offender who are willing to provide residences and other types of support. Because appropriate housing is such an important component of an offender's success on parole, we sometimes have to approve a residence that's near a school or a park because it's otherwise an appropriate place for the offender to live. It's been our experience that offenders who are homeless cannot be properly supervised, don't attend treatment, and are at greater risk to reoffend. So that's why we don't support legislation that automatically bars offenders from living in certain areas of town. We do support legislation like Senate Bill 444. We support this bill because it gives communities an opportunity to hear about all the factors that go into making a decision about placing an offender in areas that have been discussed and are described in this bill. This bill satisfies the need to place offenders in appropriate, supportive residences while still giving the surrounding community the opportunity to hear about why these decisions are being made in the way that they are. I can tell you from my experience that local parole officers consider a lot of factors before making placement like this, and they don't take these decisions lightly. And I think this will be an opportunity for the community to hear about their good decision-making process. Our role in this bill would be to draft rules that lay out the decision matrix that parole officers will abide by in making this type of placement. We have had preliminary talks about what that rule would include, but it'll include a lot of the things that you would expect parole officers to consider before this type of placement. They would look at the offender's underlying offense and type of victim, other options that the offender has, other financial resources that the offender has, whether or not the people in the residence where the offender would be are supportive of the parole conditions, and a host of other things that we will sort of hammer out through our discussions with community corrections and ultimately put into rule. So we support this bill and appreciate the opportunity to say that to you today, and I'd be glad to answer any questions if there are questions from the committee.
Diane, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Russ Spencer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And I would like, first of all, Mr. Chairman, to direct an apology to Senator Metzger, who has been trying to get a concrete position out of our association for some time and have been making great good faith efforts to do that. I have just left our legislative committee, and I now have hot off the presses our official position, which is that we do, in fact, support Senate Bill 444. However, we would ask for one amendment, and that amendment would be to delete five simple little words. And those simple little words are in Section 1, Subsection 1, when we're talking about locations. So the primary occupants or users includes, and then if we could simply delete, but is not limited to, comma, so that it reads, includes public and private elementary and secondary schools and licensed daycare centers. We believe that that provides a specific and narrow definition of what we're dealing with here, but is not limited to or always troubling words, because that essentially means we mean this and specifically this, except we might mean something else, but we're not going to tell you what we mean. And that leaves the opportunity for confusion. We think deleting those words would would make us feel very comfortable with this bill. I would be happy to...
If we didn't delete them, where's your support?
If we didn't delete them, I'm not capable of answering that question at this time, Mr. Chairman. I would have hopes of where it would be.
Questions of Mr. Spencer?
Thank you.
Thank you, Russ. All right, that pretty much concludes all of our public testimony on Senate Bill 444. Anyone else out there who did not?
With removal of those few little words, how would y'all, your group, feel about adding instead of or where children are likely to congregate? I mean, I don't know if, did I do the right process here?
No,
does that matter?
Okay.
Okay.
That's okay. That's okay. This is,
no,
this is,
that's okay. You're right. We'll, okay. But we will talk about that.
Okay.
We'll talk about it.
Okay.
And have everybody had a chance to look and see. Okay. We'll have, was there any specific reason? I mean, were there things other than it's just too general?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer for the sheriffs again. Essentially, yes, sir. It could be interpreted so broadly and so generally as to really mean just about anything. And if you go to Section 2, you find that there is language in here that talks about what the exceptions, you know, how they'll set forth exceptions to the general prohibition. So that for unique circumstances that might arise, like a, I don't know, children's convalescent home or something like that. You know, you can work through the exception process for that.
Okay.
This simply leaves the door open to really challenge on just about any basis because it's so broad and so general, included but not limited to.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Mr. Spencer, have you looked at the Dash 2 amendments that also include Line 5?
I have what was provided to me by somebody from the work group this afternoon, and I hope it's the Dash 2, so
well,
I can't attest to that.
On page 1, on page line, Mr. Chair, that same bill, the proposed Dash 2s were, it says, likely to be present is to be deleted and insert where children are the primary occupants
or
users.
Yes, sir. Yes, I do have that in front of me.
That substantially limits that, which is part of the work group's decision, was to limit that the children have to be the primary users, not just that they may be around in that a particular area.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Metzger, I understand that that's the intention of limiting it, but that still leaves the door open for a whole variety of, you know, it could be stores, parks, churches at various times. It just seems like because we are asking for an administrative rule process to be set forth here, that you know, there will be an opportunity for people to go through a procedure in order to challenge a placement here, that we don't need to leave it overly broad to more. I mean, as my understanding was, we were the reason that we went with the words, and I was not in the work group, so I say that up front. It's kind of late for me to complain. The reason that we specified public and private elementary schools and added the word licensed daycare centers is we were trying to target a very specific area that we wanted to keep protected in an enhanced method. And I think that you'd still do that while still removing those words. I just think those words leave an open door for a broad potential legal challenge.
Okay. May I ask a question, Mr. Chair?
Of course.
Before we close. Then I would assume, Mr. Spencer, that this time, before we come ask the chair for work session, that you will give your opinions and information and work with our the other members of the work group in advance.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
I know we've been trying to communicate with you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, you have, and as I said, in good faith, and it is, I'm here to apologize and tell you our organization has moved more slowly than I would have cared for it to move.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Brody.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my self-appointed capacity as committee grammarian, I would just have to point out that if you take out the words that it's not limited to, you really don't change the meaning of it. Maybe you lose some encouragement for people to think of other things, but if you just have that word includes, you've not ruled out other things. What you've done is you've eliminated a source of possible encouragement. Is that,
Mr. Chairman, correction, 6 little words.
Oh, my Lord, I'm not a mathematician, just a grammarian. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So wait a second, now, is it six words you want deleted, or five?
I think we're gonna go back up to, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Mr. Metzger, would you like to gut shoot him?
Yeah, we'll talk about it later, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, so you're talking about taking out the word includes, too?
Well, if I'm understanding your comment on the grammar, then would that not, I mean, if our objective, the sheriff's objective, I guess, is to limit this to applying specifically to public and private elementary and secondary schools and licensed daycare centers, then I don't know that you need the word includes. I don't know. I'm not an attorney, and I don't give legal advice, so perhaps that's something that council might want to look at and see
if
it's appropriate.
I think we're at the point where we're going to have some negotiating here, or just screaming and yelling, or whatever you want to call it, and come to some conclusion with respect to what you want to limit it to, or how you want it to be constructed. I mean, in one sense, you're right. You don't want to be overly broad. In a sense, you don't want to make it so limiting that you can't apply the statute where it should be applied. So with that, any other questions?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll close the public hearing on Bill 44, and Senator Metzger indicates to me that we're ready to bring it back. Is that okay?
Yeah.
And let's start with Senate Bill 247, again, public hearing. Okay, Mark McDonald, are we ready? I'm up here giggling because Senator Courtney was just on the, gubernatorial candidates show?
Yeah.
Mr. Lars.
Oh.
Tells me it might be worth recording. Mark, go ahead.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald. I'm a senior deputy district attorney with Multnomah County. I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 247. Senate Bill 247 addresses inequity that occurs to a small sub-category of defendants who are under 18 years of age when they commit certain ballot Measure 11 offenses, manslaughter in the second degree, kidnapping in the second degree, robbery in the second degree, and assault in the second degree, who are initially sentenced under Senate Bill 1049, which was passed in 1997, to a downward dispositional departure to probation, and then subsequently their probation is revoked. Currently, those individuals, again, a very small group of defendants, are sentenced to the Corrections Division. They are treated differently than other persons who are under 18 years of age when they commit a crime and sentenced to the Corrections Division. Most individuals who are under 18 and commit a ballot Measure 11 offense are waived to adult court and are sentenced to the Corrections Division, are automatically transferred to the Oregon Youth Authority. Then the Youth Authority, in conjunction with the Corrections Division, makes a decision whether or not that individual should stay in the Youth Authority or be held in the Corrections Division. This small category of individuals who are sentenced under Senate Bill 1049 to probation, unlike those individuals, are sentenced to the Corrections Division, and we think those individuals should be given the same opportunities and chances to participate in the Youth Authority programs as people who are sentenced directly to a period of incarceration. I would estimate that this would pertain to no more than approximately 10 individuals per year, if that many. We do have a couple of amendments. Our sole position is to make sure that these individuals are treated the same as other similarly situated defendants. And one would be to amend on page 2, line 23, would omit the language 24 years, 11 months, and insert 20 years. That would assure that these individuals would be treated the same as people who were sentenced directly to a period of incarceration. The current law provides that before individual can be sentenced to the Oregon Youth Authority, they have to be under 20 years of age. We don't want to give these individuals any greater rights than already exists to people who are under 18 years of age who are sentenced to a period of incarceration. The second minor amendment that we would propose is that, again, on page 2, on lines 17 and 25, we believe ORS 137545 sub 5 should be inserted there. That is the general grounds for revoking probation and sentencing somebody to a period of incarceration. The way the bill is currently written, only people who violate probation by committing a new crime would have the chance to go to the youth authority. It doesn't make much sense to allow somebody who commits a new crime to go to the youth authority and not allowing somebody who violates their probation by failure to report to avail themselves of those same opportunities. Any questions of the committee?
No, but we got a long list of people that oppose this bill, so I think you might want to hang around.
I will.
All right. Kathy Osborne.
For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne. I'm a senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. Juvenile Rights Project is speaking in opposition to Senate Bill 247 today. Not because we feel that juveniles who are on adult probation should be spending time in adult prison or in adult jails, but because of the budget considerations that need to be taken into account. Under both the governor's budget and the co-chair budget, the Ways and Means co-chair budget, the Oregon Youth Authority stands to lose 150 close custody beds. For every juvenile who was waived or sentenced under Measure 11 and goes to the Oregon Youth Authority, they are guaranteed a bed. For everyone that goes in, what that means is that there's one less bed in the juvenile justice system for a juvenile. So in other words, what we're doing is we're choosing between whether a 12-year-old should get a bed in the juvenile justice system or whether one of these juveniles who was sentenced as an adult should get a bed in the juvenile justice system. It's a very difficult distinction for the Juvenile Rights Project to make, but it comes down to this. Multnomah County is the only county where the district attorney's office refuses to meet with the juvenile department and discuss whether juveniles should be sentenced as juveniles, sent back to juvenile court after facing Measure 11 charges, or should be kept in the adult system. Multnomah County is the only county where juveniles are being put on adult probation at large rates. The numbers from Multnomah County is that Multnomah County put between 30 and 40 juveniles on adult probation after they were originally charged with Metro 11 offenses in the year 2000. That number we see is probably going to be a pretty stable number of the number of kids that we're looking at unless the Multnomah County District Attorney's charging decisions change or their decisions in terms of plea negotiations change, because when you look at the number of kids that are charged with Measure 11 offenses in Multnomah County, that number has stayed fairly stable throughout the years that Measure 11 has been in effect. So what we're talking about is that these are kids who were deemed to be safe enough to be out into the public and the supervisory authority, yet were not sent back to the juvenile department so that the county and the state can throw those kids into the hopper to look at what resources they have all the kids that they need to serve with those resources and make a determination about what's the best way to use their resources for all the juveniles that they're facing. What Senate Bill 247 does is essentially take that decision-making power out of the hands of the Oregon Youth Authority, out of the hands of the Oregon of the Multnomah County or any other county juvenile department, and puts that decision-making power into the hands of the District Attorney's Office by their decision about who they put on adult probation and then who they revoke. It seems to me if we were flush with beds in the Oregon Youth Authority and we had plenty of beds for the juveniles that need to be there, we would not be in opposition to this bill. However, we are not flush with beds. We're looking at taking 150 kids who are right now receiving the services of the Oregon Youth Authority in close custody and putting them back into the community at the same time while the budget process takes beds away from the community programs, which means putting a lot of kids in the situation of not receiving the services that they need. And these are kids who are in the juvenile system because they've committed acts which would be crimes if they were adults, but have not committed Measure 11 acts. For that reason, I would urge the committee to not pass Senate Bill 247. I'm available for any questions.
Questions? Anyone? Senator Burdick, excuse me.
Are you saying that the way this bill is written, if you have a limited number of beds, then the people who show up at Oregon Youth Authority under this measure would take priority and somebody who is occupying a bed would have to move in order to accommodate this person?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's about what I'm saying. Karen Brazeau, the director of the Oregon Youth Authority, can certainly speak to this also. But let's say that there's more than this, but let's say there's 100 beds in the Oregon Youth Authority in the close custody. The waived kids and the Measure 11 kids are guaranteed a bed. I mean, they don't, that's through a policy decision, obviously, but they get a bed, all right? The kids that are considered public safety reserve beds, they're given a bed. Those are the kids that commit serious crimes. Most of the public safety reserve bed crimes are Measure 11 crimes, but they're committed by the, you know, 12, 13, 14-year-olds. We then have the discretionary beds, which are the beds that all the counties can determine how, you know, and each county has a cap of how many kids they can send to the Oregon Youth Authority in the close custody system. If you only have a set number of beds, and let's say 20 beds are taken up by the Metro 11 and waived kids, and 10 are taken up by the public safety reserve beds because they don't count against the cap, you then have a limited number of beds that the counties can divide up. For every kid that comes in that stays a long period of time at the Oregon Youth Authority, what the effect of that has is that means that it's not that a kid doesn't come in because the Oregon Youth Authority has to take every kid that's sent to them by the courts. What ultimately happens is that the juveniles who are in the close custody system have a shorter length of stay because they have to cycle the kids in and out faster. With some counties, it's less of a problem because of the cap, but in other counties, it's more of a problem. And it gets to be confusing when she's talked about the formula for the cap, but that's generally the idea.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Kathy. Karen Brazeau. Karen, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm Karen Brazeau. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And I, too, find myself in this rather awkward position of speaking against this bill, largely for budgetary reasons, although I did have a discussion to Mr. McDonald, and I was not aware that he was proposing amendments to the bill that somewhat lessen my concerns in that the amendments would place, I think, many fewer youth into the youth authority than the bill would as it is drafted. Nonetheless, Ms. Osborne is accurate in her description of the way the system works. Unlike the Department of Corrections, the youth authority does not provide services to every youth who is committed to the youth authority for a determinate length of stay. The only youth who receive a guaranteed bed for a determinate length of stay are those that are sentenced under Measure 11. And those youth who come through juvenile court come because juvenile court is very different, and they come to us for an indeterminate amount of time, largely determined by held for an amount of time that's determined by their needs and our budgetary ability to provide services to them. So to the extent that we have more adult offenders, we are able to serve fewer juvenile offenders. That has not been a problem in the last few years. I think, as you all know, the Youth Authority was formed in 1995 in a very direct and overt effort to overcome failures of the system in the prior years. There has been an attempt by this body to make a system that has been functioning, and it's worked. We've been able to adequately serve both populations. The governor's budget and the co-chair's budget reflect a $25 million cut in the Youth Authority's budget, and that will result in cuts to the juvenile population. Those are the kids with indeterminate sentences. And that will mean one of two things. Either the juveniles will cycle through faster, or we will simply restrict who comes into us. And there is a bill that has been introduced on the House side that would restrict entrance or commitments to the youth authorities to felonies only. Let me give you an example, Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, of the Multnomah County has right now on the juvenile side their share of the juvenile beds, their portion of them are 117 beds under the co-chair's budget. They would lose about 37 of those beds. To the extent that this bill went through, they would lose more of those beds.
Would you want to give us your opinion on the governor's budget as it applies?
I support it.
Support. Seems a little schizophrenic, doesn't it?
I am.
I think we all are in this process. A little bipolar, I think, is what they call it.
I think that because I will offer an opinion, if I might. I think the governor was faced with hard choices, and because the juvenile, unlike the adult corrections, where they must take whoever is sent. On the juvenile side, it is more flexible. The state does have choices to make about how long it will keep kids and who it will serve, and it can decide to not serve some offenders and leave that up to the counties, and that was a difficult choice that the governor made.
Okay, you don't want to hear my opinion, do you?
Maybe not in this forum, no. You may like to share that with others.
Well, I guarantee you one thing. You know, there's a lot of discussion. I think there's a discussion in today's paper about Measure 11 and some reforms about Measure 11. And absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, as chair of this committee, the last place we're going to go are changes in that process when what it does is drive us back to a budgetarily driven correction system. Ain't going to happen, not on my watch. And that's what you're saying is happening here.
If I might, Chair, I would say that my opposition to this bill is largely budgetary.
Because I can take this issue to the people, and I win hands down. Governor loses, I win.
I'm kind of losing either way here.
Let me just put something on the record here, because I ran into this the other day with another administrative, other agency, just so you know, and I frustrated. In deference to the head of the Oregon Authority, her position has to be, I support the governor's budget, I oppose this bill because it's not in the governor's budget. And that is what's happening throughout the system as we are in this session, just so everybody's got to, you got to be aware of that, because I just went through an agonizing hour with the administrator, and I said, if I asked you this question, will you answer this question? No, Peter, I can't give you that answer. So you may be running into that, John, so in deference to Karen, that's just the way it is.
Actually,
that's
Senator.
What's going on. And you, Colonel, ought to love that. You ought to love that kind of take orders and give orders.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I appreciate Karen's position because at one time she supported my budget when she worked in my agency.
Senator Burr.
Okay, without commenting either way on the merits, when juveniles of the type that would potentially could be displaced by this new population coming in, the people in that category, what kind of kids are they, and what are the consequences of them having to cycle out quicker? Where do they go, and what kind of experience do you have with kids like this within the system with a longer course of treatment? Are you able to save more of them in this category than in the other category? And I know that's a big question, but...
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, I will tell you that the type of kids that end up cycling in and out or not being served at all are, in fact, perhaps the saddest kids in any of the systems. The kids who I'm speaking in generalities, but we have looked at who the population of kids are, and the low-level misdemeanant kids tend to be those kids, clearly by the nature of their crimes and misdemeanors, they're not the heavy criminal kids, but they are the kids that commit low-level crimes that have a lot of other problems. They are, while only 10% of our population are female offenders, in the misdemeanant category, 20% are females. They're very highly overrepresented in terms of mental illness. So they tend to be kids that have burned out of every other social service agency in the community and end up with us, not always because of their criminal behaviors, but because we're the bed of last resort and there is no place else for them. I would not sit here and tell you that we are the most appropriate place for them, but there is no other place for them. In terms of our ability to provide excellent services for them, we sometimes get these kids and we serve them at $100 to $130 a day. They've often blown out of $400 a day treatment programs. So we maintain them. Sometimes they mature with us. We stabilize them. Do we cure them? Probably not. Do we provide them more safety and security and better treatment than they get on the streets? Yes. And that's where they will return.
And just for the committee, I respect Karen Brazeau greatly. Actually, I think she's probably one of the most sincere and honest directors of any agency I think I've met even in the 15 years I've been in this process. So particularly admitting that you're schizophrenic on the record, that's but I do appreciate it. And I'm saying that part of the ballot measure 11 initiative issue was driven, and this goes way back to the 80s when we had caps at McLaren. We had an average stay in the penitentiary for burglary, which was a 20-year sentence in the penitentiary. The average length of stay was 49 days. And the hue and cry that came from Measure 11 and the proponents was, we can't build a correction system based on budget and budget alone. And that's why the mandatory sentences really, drove this, and that's where we're at now. This particular governor has chosen, because of budget constraints, to go a different direction. And those are the policy decisions that we'll be arguing this session.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Brazeau, this is a difficult or confusing area of the law, I think, and I wanted to see if you could help me understand a few things. I'm not, this is for real, that's a real question, not a lawyer question trying to put you on the spot.
There's several lawyers behind me who may need to help.
I see that. That's why, you know,
they're probably mocking me behind me.
The question I had is, when you said that the amendments that Mr. McDonald mentioned, mm-hmm. were you speaking of the lowering the age?
Yes.
That's the part that you see as applying this to fewer youths. Is
yes.
that correct? Okay. And can you help me understand what happens currently on a youth who does get this probation sentence under 1049 and then is revoked? What would happen to that youth?
My understanding, and you may have to, if I don't get it right, Mark can correct me, is that they go into the community corrections system in the local facility that exists in counties.
Well, to the Department of Corrections.
Yes.
If it's a more than 1 year sentence. Right.
So rather than going to OIA, they go to prison.